Chapter 5, The Digital Cell, Big Data, Programmatic Buying, and Living by the Numbers. 4 years ago, I met my fiancé through an online dating service. I had been divorced for 6 years and had been on half a dozen dating sites from Match.com to FitnessSingles.com when a colleague suggested I try OkCupid. Not only did the site have more intelligent prospects, she said, but it was free. That sounded great to me, as I'd already dropped thousands of dollars to meet, well, no one. I decided to make yet another attempt at burying my soul in the hope of finding long-term love. Like other sites, OkCupid asks a number of questions to probe likes and dislikes about a potential mate, but OkCupid's questions are direct and often a bit salacious. Questions like, do you want your partner to be kinkier than you, and say you've started seeing someone you really like, as far as you're concerned, how long will it take before you have sex, were mixed with more typical queries, such as, are you Christian? Unlike other sites, OkCupid asks how important these things are to me as they relate to being in a relationship. So I might answer no to are you a Christian, and then say that I don't place much importance on that question, thus letting potential mates know that religion is not a make-or-break issue for me. The site implores users to answer more and more questions. Mara, your profile is only 73% complete, claiming that the more questions I answer, the better the match the system would be able to find. The idea is that there is a magic number of questions, at least 100, that you need to answer in order for the site to come up with a correct match. Making this process seem scientific is part of OkCupid's sales pitch. Based on the questions answered, the computer assigns other users percentages based on how much of a match they are for you, and how much of an enemy they are. For example, someone could be a 91% match and a 27% enemy. Even the fact that these statistics are not given in round numbers provides an air of authenticity and scientific validity to them. Whatever the trappings involved, OkCupid's algorithm is simply hocus-pocus. Based on their computer analysis, I was not a good match for my fiancé, but I was lucky enough to find him in spite of this. Since then, others, including the founders of the company, have demonstrated that the numbers are virtually useless, or at least useless when it comes to helping someone find a partner. When it comes to advertising purposes, that's a whole other matter. What future daters do not know is that the questions are marketing research. For OkCupid, yes, but also for the advertisers that they are selling the information to. Of course, I understood that the site was advertising-based, but given the usual type of person who is looking for a date, I assumed that advertisers were marketing to a cohort of men and women from 20 to 50 years of age, as they had done with media in the past. At the time, it never occurred to me that the intimate questions I was answering might be used to sell me to advertisers. So OkCupid was not actually free after all. I did not pay with cash. I paid with my very personal and what I thought was very private information. I might have realized this at the time, but I was not thinking about whether or not I was being sold. I was thinking that I wanted to be back in a long-term relationship. This is what marketers and magicians count on, that we will concentrate on one thing so that we don't think about another. Not only does OkCupid use this information for advertisers and themselves, but they also manipulate information to improve their product. In one reported example, the company changed evaluations. A 30% match was revised to be 90%, and then watched the results as measured in the number of interactions between matched users. Turns out that people liked their matches after having been influenced with the idea that the other person was a good match, even if they weren't. This type of experimentation, called priming, is not new, and it is widely used in psychology and marketing. However, it is not typically used in this unscrupulous way. OkCupid's founder, Christian Rutter, seems to think that everyone is aware that this type of manipulation is happening. As he sardonically states, "Guess what, everybody? If you use the internet, You're the subject of hundreds of experiments at any given time, on every site. That's how websites work. I was not convinced, and when there was widespread public outcry following Facebook's negative manipulation of people's emotions in 2014, my suspicion was confirmed. These experiments, though, are a small part of data collection and research. Most of the information is derived from our everyday use of the Internet. Each time you go online or use your smartphone, you leave a trail of information, that is, data. What you click, what you type and delete, and how much time you spend on a page is all information that marketers can use to better understand who you are and how you shop. As we saw earlier, marketers are also gathering information through real-time listening, and more recently, they have begun to analyze the photographs we post to see what products we interact with. For example, they may look at what beverage we're sipping with our Kraft macaroni and cheese. Based on this data, specially targeted ads are sent to your computer or digital device, or marketers may use your data to improve their advertising by testing one version of an ad against another in order to see which one we are more likely to click on. Not all uses of data are nefarious. However, as more data becomes available, companies are finding more ways to use and abuse it. And when it comes to data, we generate a ton. There are more than 1 trillion Google searches per year. Google-owned YouTube has more than 1 billion users, all of whom collectively upload 300 hours of video per minute and generate 4 billion views per day. Facebook has similar video usage numbers. That translates to 8 billion video views per day on just 2 social sites. More broadly, there are 1.44 billion Facebook users, and they generate 4.5 billion likes a day. Instagram, owned by Facebook, now reaches 300 million users, making it bigger than Twitter, 284 million, in terms of active users, and it is growing while Twitter has stagnated. Instagram users send 70 million photos and videos per day. Looking at some less well-known and smaller companies, Qzone in China has 639 million users, Snapchat has 100 million monthly users, and WhatsApp has 600 million, to name a few. But those are just the social media statistics. Information is created every time you shop on Amazon or Apple, listen to Spotify or Pandora, or read the New York Times or your favorite magazine, and on it goes. There are more than 100 million Internet users each in China, India, Japan, and Brazil, and other countries like Russia, Germany, Nigeria, the United Kingdom, France, and Mexico each have more than 50 million Internet users. In the United States, while young people aged 18 to 29 are the demography with the highest percentage of users at 96%, it is not only millennials who create data streams. According to Pew Research, 84% of American adults are online, and we are all leaving a never-ending trail of data behind us. In the wake of Edward Snowden releasing NSA documents about government surveillance, we have become acutely aware of being spied on through digital technology. A number of books and articles have been written that delineate the ways we are tracked and how the information we provide is not as anonymous as we might think. A few examples prove the point. In 2006, 2 reporters from the New York Times determined the identity of a 62-year-old Georgia woman based on anonymous search data from AOL. 2 years later, researchers from the University of Texas were able to de-anonymize information, that is, identify someone by name, based on information from Netflix's database. Through that, they were able to uncover users' apparent political preferences and other potentially sensitive information. Julia Angwin, author of Dragnet Nation, former tech writer for The Wall Street Journal, and now with ProPublica, outlines a number of privacy abuses in her book. For example, 70 of the most popular websites unintentionally release private information, such as names and email addresses, to ad tracking companies 25% of the time. Major dating sites have released information on drug use and sexual orientation, and 75% of the top 1,000 websites included code from social networks that could match people's names with their web browsing habits. In the case of Facebook, for example, this means that if you don't sign out of Facebook, whenever you go to a different site that has a Facebook like button somewhere on it, Facebook knows you have been to the site, even if you don't click the link. The same is true for other social media sites. Finally, in a 2013 study, Microsoft and Cambridge University researchers analyzed the Facebook likes of 58,466 Americans. With this limited data, the researchers could accurately predict a range of highly sensitive personal attributes, including sexual orientation, ethnicity, religious and political views, personality traits, intelligence, happiness, use of addictive substances, parental separation, age, and gender. Privacy is an important issue, and these few examples merely scratch the surface. However, they are not my focus here, per se. Rather, the goal is to reveal how we are unwittingly and unthinkingly giving away our information. What most people may not have fully grasped is how and why marketers, perhaps even more so than governments, track our every move. They know what we search, where we search, and how we move from site to site. They know how much time we spend on a page, on a site, or on an article. They know if we watched an entire video or simply a few seconds of it. Amazon even knows what we read on our Kindle, how much we read, and what we highlight. All of this data is then used to pitch us products that marketers believe we are most likely to want. They can even fully customize the pitch to the prospect. For example, if the consumer is a woman in her 50s with a college-age daughter, the ad she sees online will include a 20-something female and a storyline that reflects her lifestyle. All of this information, so-called big data, intersects with marketing in two key ways. First, marketers can now assess where we are in the buying process so that they can micro-target sales pitches based on whether we're just beginning our product search or whether we're ready to push the buy button. Second, marketers have access to thousands of data points on millions of people, which they use to make educated guesses about what products and services we will want. Helping marketers to do this are the growing number of companies that amass huge quantities of information about us. Still, other companies help marketers to analyze that data and coordinate their workflow, which has become increasingly complex and abundant. Together, these companies work to target the appropriate messages to us over and over. We've seen this with OkCupid and Facebook, but they are by no means the only ones. What we post, retweet, like, and share are all used to tell marketers who we are and what we intend to buy. In all these ways, marketers use our interactions online to sell products back to us, even though we might not be aware of it. Consumer decision-making and the sales funnel. It is easy to lose sight of the fact that while branded content from Intel and GE and BuzzFeed and all the rest may be entertaining and engaging and relevant, it is also and foremost about increasing sales. And over time, technology has changed when and how marketers insert themselves into a consumer's purchase decision. The consumer decision-making process has five stages: need recognition, information gathering, evaluation of alternatives, purchase, and post-purchase behavior. Emotionally important and more expensive purchases, like a car or a computer, are called high-involvement purchases. Alternatively, a low-involvement purchase might be anything from a bottle of water to a bar of soap, anything that takes little thought or emotional investment. Given this, low-involvement purchases do not require any information gathering. If we go through the process for a car, for example, the need recognition might be that you realize you have to get to work, pick up your kids, and maybe get to school, and public transportation does not enable you to do that. You begin to gather information about different options, thinking in terms of what you can afford, what gets good gas mileage, and what car maker has the best safety record. During the evaluation phase, you go for test drives, talk to friends, read consumer reports, and visit a number of online sites to read reviews. You might also recall your past experiences with the product or with their customer service representatives. After narrowing down your choices, you think about where you want to buy the car, whether you can get the model you like in the color you want, and whether you really need an SUV or if a hatchback will do. You make your decision, you buy the car, and the marketer hopes you will love it so much you will tell your friends and family. The sales funnel is a metaphor to describe the process of moving from many choices to a limited number of real alternatives from which you will make your purchase decision, and it parallels the consumer decision-making process. The first step is awareness, when consumers find out about a product. This is where traditional advertising has existed, loud, abrasive, in-your-face ads that make you aware of a brand's existence. The next step is consideration, when consumers have a group of products that they are deciding among. Do I get the iPhone or a Samsung Galaxy, the Nikes or the Adidas, the Sony TV or the LG? Salespeople want to move us from consideration, this might be good for me, to product or brand preference. I have to have an iPhone 6. Traditionally, moving us from consideration to preference is where a salesperson in the store could have the most influence. This can still be true today, such as when you go to your local mobile phone store. Yet, introducing brand preference is highly influenced by what happens online, as we saw with word-of-mouth marketing in earlier chapters. More often than not, you will research your phone, talk to your friends, and comparison shop online, at which point you come into the store well on your way to having made your brand choice. Once a purchase has been made, companies do what they can to retain your business and get you to evangelize their product. Typical methods are asking you to follow and friend online, adding you to their email list, asking you for your phone number, or getting you to sign up for the store credit card, all of which enables the company to get more information about you while plying you with offers, many of which can be shared with friends and family. There is an important difference between old sales and marketing and new methods implemented via digital technology as it relates to this process. Marketers can insert themselves into multiple touch points along the purchase decision timeline. Most importantly, they can engage with consumers at the point of purchase. In the past, you might have seen a commercial, thought, "That's an interesting, cool, functional product," and then didn't think about the product again because you weren't anywhere near a store that sold the product. The best that marketers could do was hope that you would remember their message and buy their product while standing in a store days or even weeks after having seen the ad. Today, marketers are bidding on advertising online while you are shopping. Looking for a vacation in the Bahamas? Ads related to this search will start to follow you around the web. The same is true for theater tickets, clothes, or cars. This is done via online tracking, which will be explained in more detail in a moment, but in simple terms, it works like this. When you go to the Best Buy website to purchase a pair of headphones, a data company like Axiom or BlueKai will embed code called a cookie on your computer. Ad exchanges, similar to stock exchanges, will then auction off your cookie to advertisers wanting to reach headphone buyers, which could be Beats or Taylor Swift's record label. The highest bidder gets to display a headphone ad or an ad for Ms. Swift's last album on your device as you continue to move around the internet. Before you even get to the point of purchase, marketers can influence advocacy for products in ways that were never previously possible. We saw this in Chapter 2 when we looked at word-of-mouth or WOM marketing. Influencers on Twitter and Facebook, buzz agents, bloggers, and all kinds of people we interact with on social media drive brand preferences. Because of this, it becomes harder and harder to resist the siren call of the marketer, because they are subtly singing to you to buy, 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 and share, 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 no matter where you are online. These ongoing interactions via social media have changed the sales process into more of a loop than a funnel. Under this new schema, consumers may actually increase their viable options during the consideration stage of the process, which causes them to spend more and more time in consumer decision-making, as well as more time online. The increasing number of choices is likely to become an issue for marketers, because researchers have found that too many choices can overwhelm us to the point where we decide not to buy at all. To attempt to keep that from happening, and to ensure that their brand is the one that stays top of mind, marketers insert themselves into an increasing number of steps along the decision-making process. The need to be seen at more levels of the sales funnel has changed the way advertising is bought and sold. And now, with mobile, advertisers can deliver the entire purchase funnel, from becoming aware of a product to buying it, all in the palm of your hand, and everything is done in a few short minutes. Programmatic media buying. Buying advertising used to be a straightforward process. At its base, an advertiser would select the media vehicles they wanted to use, such as TV, radio, and magazines, and then they would negotiate the terms for placing those commercials or print ads. After the ads ran, the advertiser would assess the effectiveness of the placement based on information provided by companies like Nielsen. To complete the process, they would evaluate the impact on sales numbers and adjust media placements accordingly. Targeting, however, was imprecise, as Nielsen TV ratings are at best an educated guess about who is watching a particular show. And while marketers could place an ad in primetime in order to reach women aged 18 to 49, for example, they were also getting a lot of other people watching the ad who had no interest in what was being sold. Moreover, most products have a seasonal focus. That is, it would be silly to promote snowblowers in July when no one is thinking about winter, so it would be a rare product category that advertised 24/7, 365 days per year. Finally, as discussed earlier, advertising was purchased based on a CPM model, the number of people viewing the ad, in media terms called impressions, determined its cost. In its nascent stage, web advertising worked pretty much the same way. Rectangular banner ads on a site appeared the same way a print ad appeared in a magazine, and they were purchased like any other advertising. As time went on, new advertising formats were developed, but the buying process remained essentially the same. Google was instrumental in changing all that. To start, the search giant was a pioneer in native advertising, even before this format had a name. Sergey Brin and Larry Page, the company founders, believed that ads could be as valuable as search results. They produced ads that looked like the results of search queries, a small block of text with a link to the advertiser's landing page. These were a big win for Google. Not only were the ads more effective than the maligned and overlooked banner ads, but Google could also track which visitors were interested in each ad. At this stage in the early 2000s, Google charged advertisers on the old CPM model of selling against impressions, and the ads were sold by sales reps. The next iteration was the creation of AdWords, which was promoted with the line, "Have a credit card and 5 minutes? Get your ad on Google today." Marketers, particularly smaller companies that could not afford traditional advertising, could buy ads on their own for searches distinctly related to their products. Google would sell ads based on the word search, meaning that ads could be for highly specialized businesses. Teaching calligraphy in upstate New York? Great. Selling first editions of Judy Blume? Not a problem. This strategy was based on the long tail, an economic concept that would be made popular by Wired's Chris Anderson in his book of the same name. Through thousands of small businesses buying little bits of advertising, Google created a successful revenue source, which was something that evaded most other websites in the early dot-com days. Ads ran to the side of the organic search results so as not to create confusion, and each ad was marked as a sponsored link. The CPM model continued to prevail. The most significant way in which Google revolutionized ad buying was with AdWords Select, a service created in 2002 to sell ads based on a pay-per-click auction model. Under this system, advertisers only pay if a visitor clicks on the ad. Conversely, if no one clicks, advertisers owe nothing. The percentage of people who click to the advertiser's landing page was dubbed the click-through rate, or CTR. Placement of the ad is determined at auction, with different advertisers bidding against each other to determine the price they're willing to pay if visitors click on their ad. It behooves everyone, the advertiser, the consumer, and Google, to have the ads be pertinent to the search. However, Google did not leave this to chance. According to Stephen Levy in the Plex, there was one feature built in to try to ensure that the most useful ads would appear. Advertisers couldn't pay their way to secure the best positions. Instead, the more successful ones, the ones that lured the most people to click on them and go to the advertiser's landing page, would get priority. Thus, if someone on Google is looking for shoes and clicks on an advertiser's link, that advertiser's site had better be the equivalent of Zappos or DSW, or they'll either lose the bid or pay a premium for misleading consumers. Sheryl Sandberg, then the Vice President of Global Online Sales and Operations, said that the ad quality formula has been effective because it made the advertiser do the work to be relevant. You paid less if your ads were more relevant. So you had a reason to work on your keyword, your text, your landing page, and generally improve your campaign. Google optimizes revenue through balancing the maximum bid with the highest ad quality score, and once this is assessed, it can serve up the ad in approximately 0.26 seconds. It also doesn't hurt that more than 10 years later, 41% of Google visitors could not distinguish between paid search and organic listings, which keeps the CTR high. Two ideas are important to highlight here. First, auctioning word searches created a major shift in advertising strategy. When buying search terms, marketers are paying for our personal actions, not for content that they think we might be watching. Type SUV and Honda or Toyota ads are served to your computer, which may not be a bad thing. More questionable is that when you type depression, drug ads are sure to follow. This is very different from placing pharmaceutical ads on daytime talk shows because marketers have good evidence that women are watching those programs and are likely prospects for those medications. That sort of content targeting is generic and not attached to a single individual. Admittedly, advertisers claim that they don't care about identifying who we are as individuals so much as they care about our individual buying habits. That's probably true. However, it is very different to search for information about a medical condition and have someone know that you performed that search than it is to watch a commercial in the privacy of your living room, an act that is unknown to advertisers unless they're peering into your window. The extent of this online spying is significant when you realize that the vast majority of advertising online is search and that the vast majority of that is Google. Second, auctioning space via computer has become widely accepted for buying advertising online on all kinds of sites. Banner ads, yes, but also other online formats, including native ads. Any advertising on a web page that is bought automatically by computer is now called programmatic buying. The Internet Advertising Bureau has delineated two types of programmatic buying: direct and RTB, or real-time bidding. Direct programmatic is similar to traditional ad buying. Advertisers buy guaranteed space on a site without participating in an auction, the only difference being that a computer makes the purchase according to a set of cost and demographic parameters. Alternatively, programmatic RTB is another way of saying online auctions. It works like Google AdWords, but it is intended for display ads instead of search terms, and there are significantly more moving parts. Most of those moving parts require the use of reams and reams of our personal data. Combining programmatic buying with native advertising has been difficult. That's because creative formats are different for each site. This is purposeful on the part of the publishers. Barry Lowenthal, president of the Media Kitchen, explained it this way. The newsfeed ads have their own specs, Facebook has their own specs, Twitter has their own specs, Google has their own specs. Because each site requires different formatting for the ads, each ad has to be individually produced and cannot appear elsewhere unless it's reformatted, which is time-consuming and costly. Not surprisingly, advertisers don't like that. They want to produce one piece of creative and have it appear on multiple sites, while still looking like it is native to any site on which it is served. What they want is called native at scale, and according to Lowenthal, it's starting to happen. He says, a lot of companies now are working with publishers to create native at scale. So the publishers write the rules, there's a platform that we can upload our ads to, and when the ad is served, it looks like a native in-stream ad. They talk about it as being native, even though it's scalable. Advertisers want scalable native because it looks more like it flows rather than just a banner ad. Data brokers, ad exchanges, and programmatic buying. Companies collect, analyze, and package our information and sell it to advertisers and to each other. We used to call these companies direct mail houses. Today, they are known as data brokers. We used to call what they did database marketing. In the digital age, it is called customer relationship marketing. It used to be that they just sent you junk mail and catalogs. Today, they shadow you around the internet and send eerily specific advertising that follows you from site to email to cell phone. Importantly, the difference today is that our most sensitive information, lots of it, is bought and sold as a commodity, mostly without our knowledge. The typical purveyors of information used to be magazine publishers and credit card companies. One knew what you read and where you lived. The other knew what you bought and how much you spent. Brand companies would buy lists of names and addresses from direct marketing firms based on demographics and purchase behavior, and they would use those to send targeted direct mail messages. They might also combine those lists with internal databases they had developed through various methods, including contests, sweepstakes, or loyalty programs, this last being a bonanza of individual purchasing information. The airline industry was the first to compile information on their most loyal customers when American Airlines launched their frequent flyer program in 1981. Later, with the introduction of UPC codes and in-store scanners, loyalty programs became all the rage and moved well beyond the airline industry. If you have a plastic card on your keyring from CVS or your local supermarket, then you are part of a loyalty program. Every time you give them your card, these companies create dossiers on what you buy, when you buy, and how much you buy. But that's not all. Companies are developing group loyalty programs, like Plenty, that let retailers like Rite Aid, Macy's, AT&T, and Exxon share data on your drugs, your clothes, your contacts, and your driving habits. As noted earlier, it's not just the brick-and-mortar retailers. Online companies collect this data as well. Much of this information is innocuous. After all, who cares if you bought a book on Amazon, a bra at Macy's, or researched bicycles at REI? That's not really the issue. What becomes problematic are the topics that are, frankly, no one else's business. They tend to fall into three categories: health, wealth, and sexual preferences and proclivities. Think about it. Our privacy concerns boil down to this. We don't want people to know our medical conditions, how much money we make, and who or how many people we might be sleeping with. But we don't get to decide what information gets collected and what does not. And once accumulated, we have little to no control over how that information is used or who has access to it. Marketers employ data in a variety of ways. In 2004, for example, Walmart utilized its vast store of buying data to determine that in advance of a major storm, people buy flashlights and bottled water, but they also buy strawberry Pop-Tarts and beer. It seems that people want to prepare for the worst, but enjoy themselves while it happens. This is a fairly inoffensive use of data. Not all cases are so harmless. In The Power of Habit, Charles Duhigg explained how Target was able to determine that a teenager was pregnant based on a pregnancy prediction model that determines impending parental status based on purchases of items such as vitamin supplements and cocoa butter lotion. Unfortunately, the company spilled the beans to her father by sending coupons for baby items and pregnancy clothing to her home. Data in and of itself is useless. It is the insights derived from the information that are important. In the case of Walmart, knowing pre-hurricane purchase behaviors enabled the company to stock stores in the path of a storm with lots more pastry and suds, while Target sends out coupons for products they know we need, with the full understanding that once we are in the store, we will put a number of additional items in our cart. This is important because 92% of purchases are still made offline. For e-commerce sites, news sites, or most any site that might serve you an ad, data collection and manipulation works like this. Using cookies, a company tracks visitors' movements online and sees who purchases their product and who does not. Then they examine the common attributes of those people who converted, that is, bought a product. The information derived from the company's own website is called first-party data. But advertisers do not want to talk only to their own customers. They want to find other people who are like the people who already buy their product. In order to do that, the company does what is known as look-alike modeling, where they use the information they know about the people who buy their product in order to find more like them. This is how Sarah Evans from Great Courses described it. In a typical first-party data programmatic campaign, this is what I referred to as look-alike modeling, what we do is we pixel our website so we can catch every single user coming into that site. You basically follow them around the site, figure out how many pages they browsed, figure out if they put something in their cart, and you can track them through to purchase or conversion. So when we build these look-alike models, what we would theoretically do is take a look at anyone who came into the site and then slice it only by those who converted. And then we'd figure out what all their common attributes are. So maybe out of 70,000 attributes, there were 250 that all of those people had in common. The model is built off of people who are your customers. And the goal would be, once you build those models, you facilitate those within the exchanges, hence the look-alike modeling. You wouldn't go out and target those people again, but you would go out into the wild of the exchanges and try to find people who had those 250 attributes of the customers you did get to convert. That's one way to do it. Another way to find new prospects is to work with big data brokers, companies like BlueKai or Axiom or Nielsen, who have amassed thousands of pieces of information on us that they supply to advertisers. This information is known as third-party data. Evans explained that this is a more traditional method in that marketers set the behavioral parameters they are interested in and target people who match those behaviors from the data broker. For example, people 50 and over who are in the market for a car and who go on vacations twice a year. Using first-party data and third-party data, marketers work with the advertising exchanges to find people with similar characteristics, no matter where they might be online. More specifically, an ad exchange is a platform where websites that want to sell advertising connect with marketers who want to buy access to potential consumers. As you travel around online, you will inevitably land on a website that is trying to sell advertising inventory through an exchange. As the page loads, if there is ad space available for real-time bidding, information about you and the page you're on are sent to an ad exchange. When that happens, the exchange notifies advertisers of an auction and asks them to bid on the ad space that will be presented to you. Advertisers make a decision about whether to bid for your attention based on first-party data, information they have gotten from data brokers, or a combination of the two. If they determine that you are a good fit, they then must determine if they have a campaign running that makes sense to match up with the information attached to the cookie. Of course, there are multiple advertisers bidding at auction for our attention. The exchange selects the winning bid, and that company's ad appears on the website, a process that takes a matter of milliseconds. According to Quantcast, a company that specializes in real-time bidding, the person loading the page likely has no idea that several advertising companies were virtually fighting to get in front of him or her. That is what is so deceptive and placating in all of this. We think we're seeing a single website, when in truth we're seeing a mashup of a site with multiple entities providing content. Key components in this mix are the data brokers. Data brokers have taken the old database marketing concept and multiplied it a few dozen times over. While data companies used to collect basic demographic data like name, address, age, gender, number of kids, income, education, and so on, in total they might have had fewer than 40 pieces of information on any one person. Today, Acxiom, the biggest of these companies, claims to execute more than 1 trillion global data transactions per week, has multi-sourced insight into approximately 700 million consumers worldwide, and demographics, life stage segmentation, brand affinities, and purchase tendencies for nearly every adult consumer in the U.S. This last translates to 1,500 data points per American. Information comes from our clickstream, but it also comes from sources like the U.S. Post Office, which sells lists of when people move, public voting records, car registration, court filings of bankruptcies, and those loyalty cards on your keyring, among many others. According to privacy expert Tim Sparapani, most retailers are finding out that they have a secondary source of income, the data about their customers, which is probably just about as valuable, maybe even more so, than the actual product or service that they're selling to the individual. So there's a whole new revenue stream that many companies have found. A major collector of that information from store loyalty cards is Datalogix, owned by computer company Oracle, which claims to have information on more than $1 trillion in consumer spending across 1,400-plus leading brands, according to a report by ProPublica. But that's just the beginning. Turning offline purchase activity into digital data and connecting that data to what you do online is part of a growing trend called onboarding. LiveRamp, a company bought by Acxiom in 2014, enables the online data to be linked to offline purchase information. For example, when a store clerk asks for your email address, the retailer might share it with LiveRamp or another onboarding company. Then, when you use the email address online to sign into websites the onboarding company does business with, they can link those websites to your devices and ultimately to your name. Bearing in mind, of course, that the store's request for your email address was framed as a way to offer you discounts and let you know about upcoming sales events, not as a way for the store to secretly amass more information about you. More covert are the activities of the now-combined Verizon AOL. Verizon married its cell phone tracking supercookie with AOL's ad tracking network, which is on 40% of websites, to connect online behaviors with offline information. This is done by default. Users never opted in and likely don't even know it is happening. And in an effort to appeal to more advertisers, Twitter has created a service called Partner Audiences that allows companies to search on the social site for people who buy products in their category, say dog food. Connecting information from Twitter about purchase behavior, buying pet food, to information from data brokers enables marketers to learn how many people saw the ad and then ultimately bought the pet food brand. This is advertising's holy grail, proof positive that running an ad led to a purchase. Other major big data firms include CoreLogic, eBureau, ID Analytics, Intellius, and BlueKai, just to name a few. These companies classify us into behavioral categories, much like psychographics. Because there is so much more information than in the pre-digital era, these segments can be much more granularly defined. Datalogix, for example, has developed 1,800 different audience segments, from car buyers, categorized by maximum spenders, car owners, and likely in the market to buy, to consumer packaged goods, broken down by category, brand, and product, to lifestyles, soccer moms, green consumers, sports fans. Segments of particular interest to marketers and readily offered by all the data brokers I looked at are people going through major life changes because they are more likely to spend money across a number of different categories. People who purchase a new home, for example, spend more on products and services in 6 months than an established resident spends in 2 years. And that might include anything from cleaning products to window blinds to a new refrigerator to services from local merchants like restaurants and gas stations. Having children is another major life change. Not surprising, then, that Target was interested in pregnant women. The goal is to get families to establish a habit of coming to their store for everything, since a one-stop shop is useful to someone with an infant, but also means more money for the retailer. Experian, the same company that provides credit reports, has a separate marketing arm that keeps an up-to-date list of expectant families and those with newborns. To get the extent of the data these companies acquire on us, we will look at Acxiom, but much of this can also be found on any number of data broker sites. Like Datalogix, Acxiom categorizes us by products we buy, media we use, and industries that are trying to put advertising in front of us. For people into social media, for example, this data broker can find social influencers and those who are socially influenced. They can find heavy users of Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, and YouTube. And they can find people who have a propensity to post photos and videos. If an advertiser is one that markets during back-to-school season, now the second largest sales period of the year, they can find just the type of person a marketer might be looking for, as Acxiom provides segments such as stylish students, which might appeal to brands like Express or Diesel, or essential electronics for companies like Apple, Best Buy, and Samsung. There's even a segment called the early bird for customers who like to shop early. The company prides itself on its depth of information. In explaining back-to-school shoppers, the website states, "Reach customers likely to shop as early as 2 months before school starts, or aim your message at customers that buy their supplies 1 month ahead, or even the week after classes begin." Acxiom datasets are that specific. Beyond back to school, they provide similar breakdowns for 11 other key time periods throughout the year, including the big game, the Super Bowl, Christmas, and Mother's Day. The last category includes information on the getaway guy, one who is likely to surprise an overworked wife or a deserving mom with a relaxing cruise or other getaway. Talk about specialization. You can get a sense of how data brokers and ad exchanges work if you put an extension on your web browser that allows you to see who is tracking you or who wants to feed you advertising. There are two that are particularly useful. Ghostery tracks the data companies and advertising tracking firms that are following you when you go to a website. Disconnect is another extension that does similar analysis. After you install the app and go on any website, a list of the companies tracking you will appear on your computer screen. Companies that will populate on your screen may include DoubleClick, an ad network owned by Google, big data firms like AdThis, and ad exchanges like Brightroll. On a recent visit to moviephone.com, Disconnect counted more than 64 advertising requests from companies like Rocket Fuel, Brightroll, ValueClick, and Datalogix, 10 requests for analytics, all from ComScore, 1 social request from AddThis, and 128 content requests, most of which were from DG, a programmatic video provider. In sum, there were more than 200 requests for information about me, okay, my IP address, all from a single web page. In addition to lists, Disconnect will present the information as an infographic by representing the site that you're on as a circle surrounded by spokes, each of which ends with the logo of the company tracking your data. There is something about seeing those bubble-like logos populating the screen that is very disconcerting. More so when you begin to get advertising that does not relate to anything about you. Just the other day, I was watching a video, and the pre-roll ad that came up was for bipolar disorder. In the past, I might have laughed that off. Now, I can only wonder what I might have been doing that would make a marketer of some anonymous company think I need this medication. And while it was later explained to me that this drug ad was likely a demo target, older and female, it did not make me feel any better. In truth, there is no way to know this for certain. One issue has loomed for marketers until very recently: how to track us once everything moves to mobile. That is because cookies work for computers but not for mobile devices, sort of. Cookies do work on mobile, but they're limited in their functionality, and they vary across applications, apps versus mobile web, and devices. Mobile web browsers accept first-party cookies, but not all will accept third-party cookies. When you are on an app, cookies can be stored, so you can be served all of those really annoying ads. But the cookies are unique to the application, so they can't be shared with other apps or with your mobile web browser. Companies have been using a workaround to compensate for this. According to Arvind Narayanan, a professor of computer science at Princeton, let's say you have a laptop and a smartphone, and you're traveling with them, and you're browsing the web through Wi-Fi. The advertiser, or other company, notices that there are two particular devices that always connect to the website from the same network. The chance of this happening coincidentally is similar to the chance of two people having the same travel itinerary. So, after a period of time, if it keeps happening, they can deduce that it's the same person that owns those two different devices. Now they can put your browsing behavior on one device together with your browsing behavior on the other device and use it to build a deeper profile. This is becoming less of an issue as companies such as Drawbridge and Tapad are able to track our movements across devices. Content, particularly video content, is moving increasingly toward mobile, and with that, the ability to integrate data across devices as easily as possible is high on marketers' agenda. I spoke with Kara Goldberg, the PR manager of Virul, one of the major distributors of branded video to multiple devices. Kara explained that the company has three products: ActiveStream, like the pre-roll you see before a YouTube video, Social, in games or apps, and their latest tool, the Inline Video Ad Unit. When you read an article, either on a website or a mobile device, the inline video ad unit pushes the text down to expose the video, and the audio will play only when you mouse over it. What makes this particularly interesting and effective for advertisers is that it opens up new inventory. Whereas on Facebook, ads appear as another post, this advertising unit is embedded in the content and is therefore harder to avoid. This accounts for inline unit's 2.5% click-through rate, compared to 0.8% with pre-roll, according to Virul. We also spend more time watching these videos, 24 seconds versus 5 seconds for pre-roll. Another company distributing mobile video in native environments is LoopMe. As Carlos Cruz, the company's senior director, explained, feeding video is good, but using data to fine-tune targeting of those videos is the goal. He says, data is becoming a larger focus of our industry, and with that comes machine learning. While we still have campaign managers looking at our efforts, AI, artificial intelligence, is now taking the lead on that front. AI can handle multiple data points, like identifying a poor-performing publisher, but also recognizing that on a certain day and at a certain time during the week, It may be the best performer on the campaign and deliver inventory accordingly. In addition, it provides sophisticated attention to all advertisers, from the largest to the smallest of efforts, all receiving round-the-clock attention. LoopMe can do this because they gather data at all times, even when they aren't serving up the mobile ads. Cruz adds, "Using our data management platform, we can collect up to 30 data points on the viewer when we receive an ad call on mobile or tablet devices without even serving the ad. This allows us to collect vast amounts of first-party data on the viewers, which can be layered with third-party, BlueKai, Neustar, or second-party advertiser data to create a custom target and better reach our target viewer." All of this goes to show that, as big as big data is now, it will only continue to grow as we provide ever-increasing amounts of data, not only on our phones and our tablets, but through our Fitbits and our Apple Watches and whatever else becomes part of the Internet of Things. We can be sure that ads will find us on these devices as well. The problem of big data. What is incredible to grasp is that no one has been able to determine how many of these data companies there are. In part, that is because they all do a number of different things, so it's difficult to categorize them. Yes, they amass data, but they also do data analytics. Some companies just analyze the data. Some use the data to sell advertising, ad networks, and ad exchanges. Other companies, like Google, gobble up data and keep it for their own purposes. It is confusing, and as with other aspects of black ops advertising, it is designed to be that way. The best guesses, however, are that thousands of companies hold millions of pieces of information. But while the companies collect data, they don't always get it right. And the more data they collect, the more opportunities they have to get it wrong. Axiom allows you to see some of the data they have on you through aboutthedata.com. For the most part, my information was incorrect, and this isn't an isolated case. Recently, I tried to log into my health provider's website, but had forgotten my password. They asked if I would like to answer a couple of questions so that they could identify me. I said, sure. The question that came up was, "At which of the following addresses did you live with Estee Einstein?" Estee Einstein is my ex-husband's ex-wife, and I can assure you that I never lived with her. What was disconcerting was that the company made inferences about me. In this case, it was creepy, but not ultimately detrimental. However, data mining is increasingly used to infer behavior and preferences that can be used against consumers. Far worse is that we have no control over this, because decisions are being made not based on what we post, but what our friends post. About us, yes, but also what they post about themselves, which then reflects on us. The U.S. Army, for example, uses Facebook for recruitment purposes, because they can infer that if a number of your friends are in the military, you are more likely to enlist. Mac users are considered more discerning and will spend more money for computers, so Orbitz shows Mac users more expensive hotel options. More broadly, companies use dynamic pricing, meaning that they offer different prices based on where you live and how you shop. The Wall Street Journal found that major companies like Staples, Office Depot, and Home Depot were consistently adjusting prices and displaying different product offers based on a range of characteristics that could be discovered about the user, based on information derived from browsing history and geolocation. Similarly, banks determine whether you're a good credit risk based on whether you associate with people who pay their bills on time. Shockingly, in August 2015, Facebook announced that they were granted a patent on technology that discriminates against borrowers based on their social network. The company described how it would work in the patent application. When an individual applies for a loan, the lender examines the credit ratings of members of the individual's social network who are connected to the individual through authorized nodes. If the average credit rating of these members is at least a minimum credit score, the lender continues to process the loan application. Otherwise, the loan application is rejected. This is the digital version of redlining, when banks drafted maps of U.S. communities in the 1930s and cut off from credit those that were unworthy of mortgage lending, typically because of race. Facebook is not alone in this. Racial inferences are also made about services necessary for different internet users. In a study by Harvard professor LaTanya Sweeney, research determined that names that sound black, like Trayvon Jones, will generate ads suggesting that the person has an arrest record 25% more often than a white-sounding name. In his book Black Box Society, Maryland law professor Frank Pascal terms these misuses of information runaway data. Other scholars have dubbed it big data hubris, which is the implicit assumption that big data are a substitute for, rather than a supplement to, traditional data collection and analysis. An example here is the oft-cited Google flu, whereby the search engine claimed that they would be able to track an influenza outbreak faster than the CDC, under the assumption that people will search for remedies for their flu symptoms. On the face, this seemed like a good idea. Turned out, not so much. People are not good at diagnosing themselves and typed in flu, whether they had it or not. Subsequent research found that Google flu was wrong 100 out of 108 weeks. The latest trend is for companies to put a friendly face on when explaining why you got the ad you did. Facebook has a video that does this, as do a number of publishing sites like Cosmopolitan, which redirect you to the webpage for the Digital Advertising Alliance, www.aboutads.info/. This site's rhetoric frames big data-driven advertising as serving us better ads, in the same way that content marketing is framed as informative and entertaining. That is all fine and well, but we should also consider why all of this information is being collected. Google, for example, compiles thousands of pieces of data about us, and most of it is unnecessary. Craig Heimbuch of Barefoot Proximity / BBDO explained that while Google has all of this information on us, there are really only six things that he is interested in knowing. How did they find it, the website / content? How long did they stay? If they left, where did they go? If they stayed, what did they do? What did they click on next, and volume? So why are companies collecting so much more information? In part, it allows marketers to justify their jobs. In the digital space, marketing can be tracked and quantified. Marketers talk endlessly about return on investment, or ROI. In the past, ROI was all about sales. Today, it's all about the relationships they've made with consumers, and particularly with millennials. No matter what data brokers or marketers claim, however, consumers are not happy about big data. Here are some stats. 82% of global consumers believe that companies collect too much information on consumers. Adobe, June 2013. 86% of U.S. internet users have attempted to remove or mask their online activities, despite only 37% believing it possible to be completely anonymous online. Pew Research Center, September 2013. 93% of email users believe that users should be able to opt out if they don't want the content of their emails to be scanned in order to target ads. GfK and Microsoft, November 2013. Even more recently, research by Joseph Thoreau of the University of Pennsylvania and his associates found that we do not want to pay with our data, even if it allows us access to platforms like Facebook and Google for free, or gives us discounts on purchases. What we are paying now, in terms of the value of our data and attention, is far more than what we paid in an analog world. In the United States, not much has been done to protect consumers from marketers and their manipulation of our data. FTC Commissioner Julie Brill has pushed for more oversight, but to little avail, even given the new FTC guidelines. Senator Jay Rockefeller, chair of the Senate Commerce Committee, proposed legislation to increase transparency and spent more than a year investigating the industry, only to be stonewalled by Axiom, Epsilon, and Experian. But this is not the case everywhere, and particularly not in Western European countries. According to Julia Angwin, those countries require all data collectors to provide individuals with access to their data, the ability to correct errors in that data, and in some cases, the right to delete the data. These are the so-called right-to-be-forgotten laws, whereby if you ask a corporation to delete unflattering material, they must comply. Not surprisingly, Google has appealed the case and, from all appearances, intends to fight this vociferously. In a twist of irony, I got the following email while I was finishing this chapter. Talk about your data hubris.